Oh, you gotta look at my thing. I got the. It's very handy. I didn't know what it was. Also, yeah, you got one also, right? But my teenage daughter had to show me how to actually use it. But it's yeah, it's good shit. My kids use it more than me, but that's with most toys. Okay. So they tell a story of a young man who's about to get engaged, and before the future father-in-law is going to give over his hand of his daughter, they ask him, what are your plans? He says, I'm going to sit and learn Torah. So that's a wonderful thing. So how do you plan on supporting my daughter, your future wife? He says, God will provide. Okay. So he asks him more plans about that. Well, are you know, you're eventually planning on starting a family. How are you going to afford to buy homes? God will provide. Planning on marrying, working, having a family, God willing, there'll be kids down the line. Who's going to support your kids? Tuition, bills, diapers, all things, food, groceries. Says, don't worry, God will provide. Well, that's okay. So the mother-in-law comes in and talks to her husband and says, what do you think? Should we let him marry our daughter? So he's a great boy, but he's got one small problem. What's the matter? He thinks I'm God. My father-in-law likes that joke. My mother-in-law does not like that joke. He thinks I'm God. So I want to discuss with you a little bit about the story of Esther, because we don't find Hashem mentioned at all. His name is not there. And that's remarkable. There's only one other book. Do you know by any chance, take a guess, what other book in the Tanakh, in the Torah, doesn't have God's name anywhere mentioned in it? Take a guess? It's in Shir HaShirim. The Song of Songs, they translated. God's name is not mentioned that, and he's not mentioned in the Megillat Esther. I recently heard a story. There was a famous tzaddik, his name is Rebbe Maharash, and he was in Russia. He was in a very deep thought, and he wasn't paying attention. Apparently in Russia, they had certain areas where Jews were allowed to walk, and like a boundary as to where you were not allowed to walk. And he was just lost in a deep meditative trance, and he was walking. And the Russian soldiers saw that he passed this line where you weren't allowed to go anymore. So they ran over to him, and he started threatening him. And at first, like he was just in his thoughts, he didn't realize what was happening. Then finally he came out of it, and he looked at him. And the Russian says, the soldier says to the Rebbe Maharash, he says, who are you? Why are you here? And he just looked at him. And instead of answering the question, he asked this Russian soldier, says, how much should they pay you a day? What's your daily wages to like, you know, it was like, you know, here he is. He could have, his life was on the line. He was so taken back by the question. So he actually answered him. He says, I get 10 rubles a day. So the Rebbe turned to him and says, I'm going to pay you 10 times that amount if you'll ask me that question every day of my life. Who are you and why are you here? Because that's the most important question we have to ask ourselves. Who are you and why are you here? So I was thinking about that. That's a very appropriate, I just heard this story recently, but it's a very appropriate introduction to understanding the story of Esther. When you don't see God in your lives, the question is, you know, who am I? Why am I here? God is always there. You know, imagine like when remember the Sound of Music where they had the little puppet show with the marionette dolls, right? Mm-hmm. That's God. Hashem is running the world, and every politicians and every major figure is just God orchestrating the strings and pulling the puppets and pulling in the strings. But I want to show you some of this fascinating, I'll call it, aspects of Esther, if you will. So if you look, I picked out, I tried to cut and paste and put them into more or less chronological order. I just want to go through a few things that we know about Esther and then try to develop that, see how we can, what lessons can pull out. So the first thing is that we see that Esther, very low, so she had no parents, she was an orphan, but she was attractive. So the Torah says, he raised his cousin Hadassah, this is Mordechai, right, her uncle, also called Esther. So the first thing is her name isn't really Esther. Do you know what the name Esther means in Hebrew? It means concealment. That's not her name. Her name is Hadassah. So they call her, we all call her Esther. Could you imagine if your parents named you concealment? Like what must do for like your self-image? What's your name? Concealment. I mean, my own daughter's named Esther, so I can make the joke. But but it's strange, right? That's not the name we expect for her. She had neither father nor mother. Right? So she's orphaned. It says that her father passed away while she was pregnant and her mother died of childbirth. So she really was left all alone in this world. This girl who at the ripe age, we could guess she was about 11 or 12 in Persian society when she was taken to Ahasuerus, right? By that was the marriageable age in that time period. So the girl was a beautiful form, beautiful visage. When When her father and mother died, Mordechai adopted her as his daughter. That's the first thing we're told about. One thing we're told about Esther. Another thing, in number two, is that there's a subterfuge in the fact that she doesn't reveal, she's told not to reveal who she really is, right? Chapter 2, verse 10, all the while Esther did not divulge her race or ancestry, for Mordechai had instructed her not to tell. She's just following orders. She does what she's told. She has restricted movement, maybe not exactly jail per se, but she's in the palace. She can't leave there. We know there's the beauty pageant, right? That's essentially, and it takes 6 months that she's being perfumed and pampered, and so she'll look her best when she goes in to see the king. Now, you got to understand what happened in that society. If, let's say, the king did not want you as one of his wives, it's not you went back to high school. You became a harem. It was a life sentence. The choice really was not good or at least manageable, right? There wasn't really a win-win situation in this. Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tevis, in the 7th year of his reign. So she's taken, but basically she's very restricted. So you can kind of think of that a little bit like a jail. But it is a love story. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won his favor and kindness more than all the virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in Vashti's stead. That's right. So we know that Vashti is out of the picture. And now Esther, this little unknown girl who doesn't tell anybody anything about her, who she is and where she's coming from, she now is the queen. Right. Another interesting point in the story, number five, now the king has a very troubled night of sleep. Right? The Ahasuerus was paranoid. The entire first chapter of the Megillah is dealing with this very elaborate party that he had and a whole coronation ceremony. The reason why, without going into too much of the historical background, it was an unstable kingship. He was paranoid. And sometimes there's healthy paranoia. If they're really out to get you, you should be paranoid. He had a healthy paranoia. People were out to get him. It wasn't that he had to crush rebellions and to consolidate his power. And he thinks in the back of his mind, when this charming wife Esther, who risks her life, because she knows and he knows that if she's not officially invited to come into the royal room, that's a death sentence. So what did she ask for? She comes in, Esther, and she's standing there. And he realizes, wow, what's she going to ask for? For another Rolls Royce, another diamond ring, a bigger pal? What is she going to ask for? She says, I'd like to make a party, and I want this guy Haman to come along also. So Achir is, whoa, why is she asking for a party with me? And she wants my number one prime minister to come along with her. Right? And then they have the whole party, right? And then she comes again, and she says, okay, what do you want? I'll give you half of the game. It's yours. If I found favor in your eyes, yes, you have. If I do anything you want, yes. Can we have another party again? And can Haman come again to the party? So in Ahasuerus' mind, he's thinking that they're out to get me. This is it. He's troubled. He's trying to find a way to, how am I going to show that I'm a strong king, I'm a loyal king, I reward people who protect me. And that's the background. You look in, we're now to chapter 6, verse 1. That night, meaning between the party, the king's sleep was disturbed. He ordered the book of records, the chronicles, be brought, and they read before the king. It was found written that Mordechai had informed on Bigtan and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains from the threshold guards, who had planned to assassinate the king Ahasuerus. This was an inside job. These were his right, and these were the guys he used to taste test the wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. And they themselves are coming after him. He's 100% paranoid, but he should be, because they're after him. They're trying to kill him. So when you put all these details, these minor details together, we still have an insight as to why, on the one hand, he was so eager to reward Mordechai, to show that I need people to protect me, to look out for me, because look how good you'll be treated if you save my life, it's going to be good for you. And the other hand, he's very afraid. Okay, then the next thing, there's a party with the adversary. In chapter 7, verse 1, the king and Haman came to drink with Queen Esther. Another thing that Esther becomes, she's the queen, she's so powerful, right? The second day, the king said to Esther during the wine feast, then no one gets drunk. By the way, it's important to realize there is a lot of wine, but they're not drunk when these things are happening. What's your plea, Queen Esther? We grant you what's your request, even if behalf the kingdom be fulfilled. Right? So he says, I'll give you almost anything you want. And then she rises like a meteor. Mordechai, now this actually is about Mordechai, but it applies to Esther as well. Mordechai was prominent in the king's palace. This is chapter 9, verse 4. His fame was spreading throughout the province, for Mordechai was growing in power. So we have 8 ideas about this. But I want you to think for a second. We'll open up for discussion. Look at what we know about Esther. Parents aren't involved in the picture. Very attractive person. doesn't reveal her identity. She has restricted movement. There's a love story going on. There's a king who has a troubled night of sleep. There's parties with your adversaries, becomes second in command, and rises like a meteor in status. What story does this sound awfully familiar to in the Torah? Take a guess.
Joseph.
That's right. You also get a donut. Look at it. This is the story of Yosef, of Joseph. Every single one of these things that happens to Esther happens to Joseph as well. Now, it's not a textual class right now where we go and we line up, we'd open up and show you the exact, but each one of these has a parallel passage. Rabbi Yitzhak et Shalom discusses this 10 years ago. I heard a class from Mrs. Dina Knoll who lines up these parallels. But no parents will, again, Yosef, his mother is no longer alive, and his father is there, and he's all by himself while he's a young man in the land of Egypt. Doesn't reveal his identity. Oh, I guess his name changed. Tzafas Paneach. He pulls this whole trickery to get the brothers to come down. He accuses them, and they didn't recognize him because when he was a little kid, he didn't have a beard, and now he does have a beard, so he recognized them. They didn't recognize him, so he's not telling them who he is. Esther doesn't reveal her identity. Yosef doesn't reveal his.
It actually reminded me of it when we got to the king had a troubled night of sleep.
Oh, that's the easiest one, right? Paro can't sleep. He's got this dream that's baffling him. Achashverosh can't sleep, right? And then what happens right next? That's when everything starts to change, right? The love story, okay, so it does actually say, if you look in the text, it says that Yaakov loved Yosef, right? So you find that idea of love. You also have the whole story with the wife of Potiphar, and all that is the troubled night of sleep. The parties, so Yosef sits down and has a meal with his brothers before they recognize him, right? Esther with him, second in command, that's also a very, glaring similarity. Yosef is the second, and he's the vice president. Esther, and this meteor rise in power, right? He gets the dream right. He gets some good advice, and all of a sudden he's up there. Esther, this unknown orphaned girl, and she can have half the kingdom. So now that we've seen this, and starting to get the wheels turning a little bit, now that we see there's a definite connection, the question is why? It couldn't just be these things that are a coincidence. If it's written in Megillas Esther, has all these events happening. So let's try to put it together. Hashem's name is nowhere in the Megillah, right? Is Hashem's name found with Yosef? Mm-hmm. All the time. Every step of the death, you can't turn a page in the Torah when you're reading these narratives about Yosef. It's constantly, the name is so, it's called Shagar B'Fiv. It's just so fluid, it's flowing in his mouth. So I'm suggesting you have two extremes over here. You have Hashem's name over and over and over and over again, and you have Hashem's nowhere. Maybe there's like hints to it, like slight ways you could find allusions to it, but it's not said explicitly in the text at all. So we have these two different extremes. We have a salvation coming about, and people being saved, and people being helped in both of these, but there's something major that happens. So chronologically, we know there was a big party, the whole feast that starts off the whole Megillah. Do you know why that feast was arranged? What was it to? I mean, it is to make the power and to get everybody involved, but there was a prophecy that the temple was going to be destroyed for 70 years, and then it was going to be rebuilt. The Jews knew about this, the non-Jews, everybody knew that the prophet said that the God's temple, the base of Migdash, is going to be destroyed, and it's going to be rebuilt. So they miscalculated, they thought the 70 years were over, and it wasn't going to be rebuilt. Meanwhile, simultaneous to this is happening, there are two great leaders, this is in Persia, in the land of Israel, at the same time, they're sitting down having this party, there are Jews with Ezra and Nehemiah, and they are leading the Jewish people back to Israel to rebuild and to start rebuilding now what will become the second base of Migdash. So the question is, what are Mordechai and Esther doing in Persia when they should really be in Israel right now, helping rebuild? You don't realize this because there's so many different things that are happening simultaneously, but historically speaking, this is a very bleak period of time. They thought that the redemption was going to come, and it didn't, but on the other hand, you have Jews who are actually actively taking a major role in rebuilding the future home of Hashem. So, when we look at the character of Esther, there's a passivity. Without going through all the things, we don't even bring Megillas here, but we'll talk about a few examples where we see she's chosen as the queen. She's brought to the palace. She's told what to do by Mordechai. over and over and over again. You look on your own. Before Purim, you'll open up the Megillah and you'll see that everything that she does is passive. She does not take an active role in it whatsoever. Right? Turn to the next page for a second. We'll see where the shift happens. So now, we know that Haman had gotten permission from Ahasuerus to have this royal decree that in 11 months from now, the Jewish people are going to be wiped out. And it's a scary time. I mean, trying just to make it... America is nothing but being kind to the Jewish people. But just imagine for a second, if we're living in a country where the official government said in 11 months from now, permission is granted for every single citizen to get up and kill the Jews. It's a law, there's nothing you can do about it, so we'd be terrified. Again, thank God in America it's been such a kind country, but could you imagine it? Scary. So look at what Mordechai says. This is on the top page. The top of the second page, Mordechai said, "Relay to Esther." Now, there's intermediaries. They're not talking directly because he's not allowed in the palace and she doesn't come out. Don't think that you're going to escape the fate of all the Jews by being in the king's palace, right? I got a rich uncle. I got a job lined up for me after graduation because I know somebody in the company. We got our man in the White House, right? Don't think that. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and salvation will come to the Jews from another source. You might be the intermediary, the shliach, to bring this about, but it's going to happen. If you don't step up, don't think that you're free. Someone else is going to do it. You and the house of your father will be lost. And who knows, if it's not just for such a time that you reach this royal position. Meaning, Hashem is pulling the strings, and he's manipulated historical events. We see this in our own life. The things that defy any rational explanation of how certain people achieved political office. I remember the Chad ballots in Florida, maybe 12 years ago, more or less, I think 2000 or so. I think that was the election where you had a president who lost the popular vote, Bush, but nevertheless, because of the Electoral College, President Bush got in. Right, so President Bush got into office, and he was such an action. He was so stubborn, he kept pushing. You have to go after Saddam Hussein. And they really didn't want it. And basically, he politically, it didn't make sense, but he pushed that through Congress. And they went through, and they brought the American troops. I'm not saying pro or negative, I'm just pointing out what happened. He went in, they went after Saddam Hussein, and they caught him, right? They got him, they found him in the hole. They thought he was going to be living in some big palace like Osama bin Laden. He was like a rat in the hole. They caught him, and they executed him. The day that Saddam Hussein was caught and executed was Purim Khatan. So you find the leader of Iraq, right? Who are they saying? So can we explain exactly why all these events happen? No. But the message of the Megillah is to read the New York Times and connect the dots from 6 months to 6 months to 6 months to 6 months. I'm not talking politics. That's not my thing at all. But it's remarkable that our current president is an individual which is unprecedented. He never held a military position or never held a political position. He was a successful, wealthy businessman and became the next president of the United States, which, again, every single one of the previous 44 presidents had either one of those two qualities. He didn't. So again, I don't care about politics, but you have to understand that something's happening, right? So Hashem is running the wheels. So look what Esther now realized was, you know what? He's right. And now this is the shift. When that realization kicks in that I can't remain passive and expect for everything just to work out, I have to do something. Esther now says, relays the following message back to Mordechai. And this is where it changes. She now stops being passive. And throughout the rest of the Megillah, everything she does is now an active. She starts giving the orders. Instead of having Mordechai telling her what to do, she says, "Go and gather all the Jews who are in Shushan and fast for my sake. Don't eat, don't drink for 3 days, night and day. My maids and I shall also fast the same way." Meaning Esther says, "I'm not going to eat for 3 days straight. Then I'm going to go to the king. Though it's unlawful, and if I perish, I perish." Mordechai then left and did all that Esther had instructed him. So you just see that Esther, from being told what to do, now she's calling the shots. And it's remarkable. Esther, there's different opinions. The one opinion in the Gemara says that Esther was not really physically attractive. It said she had a greenish complexion. I don't know, like Shrek maybe, I don't know. But she had a greenish complexion, but there was what's called a chut shel chesed, that she had a special something special about her that endeared her to him. So if we understand there's something special about Esther's physical appearance is what causes Ahasuerus to like her. So if you look at what she does before, she's going to go in now and plead unannounced, uninvited. She's literally taking her life in her hands. He could kill her, right? Unless he decides to break his own rule and extend the scepter. And if you get the scepter extended, you're allowed to come in, which he does, obviously. But before she goes into him, she says, I'm going to fast for 3 days a night. I don't know. My wife's not here. But I don't think before my wife and I dated, she decided I'm going to really want to look nice. I'm going to fast for 3 days a night before our first date. I want to look my best. Usually when the girl gets dressed, puts on the makeup, the hair, the other, right? Does all the, okay, you want to look around? Lubavitcher Rebbe said, why didn't Esther go to the spa for 3 days? She's got to make her best impression upon Ahasuerus. Dress, doll yourself up, all the perfect things. No, because if you realize Esther's now taking action, Esther realizes, I have to do my effort, but at the end of the day, whether I'm successful or not depends on Hashem. And that's the formula for success. We have to do our, what's called hishtablus. We have to put our effort in. You have to put your effort in. How much effort a person has to put in, that's a discussion. It depends on what level a person's at. How much time to do more hishtablus, more effort. Some need to do less hishtablus. But you have to do something. So Esther says, I'm doing it, but I'm showing at the end of the day, I'm fasting for 3 days and nights. It's all up to God whether it's going to happen. And then, as we know, that's when things really start to move. I'd like to bring out a few more points. Let me move to the meaning behind the name, right? So we were talking about how Esther means concealment. That's not her name. Most people in the Megillah itself are not really using their real names. It's a fascinating discussion, but beyond our scope for now, how people in the Megillah, Mordechai was really originally a name. Now it's a very common Jewish name, Mordechai. It's a beautiful Jewish name. Esther's a very common name, but these were Persian names. They were named after idols. We communisted them. We took the names for ourselves, but the origin, they're not Jewish origins at all. So what does it mean? The name Esther itself is an indication as to how she led her life and fulfilled her role. The root of Esther in Hebrew is Hester, which means hidden. Often, we think when someone's hiding, it's a situation of embarrassment or discomfort. The modern day concept is, if you got it, flaunt it. Show the world what you have to offer. Be out there, be public, the more the better. It isn't so exciting to be the heroine behind the scenes. But that's exactly what happened. You know, sometimes people feel like they have to be in the forefront in order to make a change. So a friend of mine told me a beautiful story that he heard in one of the local shuls, that the rabbi of the shul told a story. Somebody asked Rav Chaim Kanievsky how to make a chosin and kala happy at the wedding. I'm not a good dancer. I can't dance. So what can I do? Like, I want to do something to make them happier, but what can I do? So Rav Chaim Kanievsky told them, go stand in front of the band. Go stand and watch the band. Because the band realizes that people are watching them, it's going to make them want to play better. And by them wanting to play better, the people are going to dance better. So you're going to cause them. You're not going to be the one up there doing all the crazy shtick and doing the cartwheels and burning the hats and, you know, juggling. You're going to stand in front of the musicians. And I thought that was such a beautiful story, because many times we can affect change, but we don't have to be in the limelight. And I think that's the message of Esther. She was in the limelight, but the name itself, she's not called by Hadassah, she's called by the name Esther, which means to be hidden and to be concealed, because we can do things in a quiet way. And modern day society is everything but that. It's all about how quickly you can get your name in lights, how much you can bing, zing, Twitter, blitter, all your stuff. And if it's not on Facebook, it didn't really happen. People feel like they have to compel. I was talking to a psychologist, they're telling me this crazy, the phenomenon becomes like almost an unhealthy relationship where you, on Facebook, you like something. A like has no value whatsoever. But you like something, and then you do that because you think they're going to turn around and reciprocate it and like you back. So it becomes a vicious cycle of it's meaningless, and people get caught up in that. Many times the things that are not flaunted, the things that are most private and concealed, those are the most beautiful and most meaningful things. When you have a personal private struggle that nobody else knows about, that's your moment of being like Esther. The name itself means to be hidden and concealed. And sometimes it's when you're in the limelight, it's easy to do the right thing because everyone's watching and everyone's going to see. You know, somebody does something and embarrasses you in public. So you could choose to respond, choose not to respond. So if you respond, okay, people understand. You got embarrassed each other to lash out back. But if you don't, Wow, did you see that? Didn't say anything. So sometimes it's easier when it's in public. But when it's private, sometimes those types of battles are a little bit more difficult. On the last page, we're often deceived by the opaque nature of our interactions with God. He seemingly doesn't react when we go off the path. We're not stricken down by lightning when we make bad choices. I remember I had a friend of mine in college, and the kid came from a religious home and a religious upbringing. He went to yeshiva, and he knew better. And he told me he decided to stop keeping kosher. And he told me like the scariest thing in his life was the first time he went into a non-kosher restaurant and ordered lobster. He told me, again, he's a normal, he said, I thought of, and it wasn't a joke, it wasn't exaggerating, he said, I thought a bolt of lightning was going to come through the ceiling and strike me dead. And it didn't, so I ordered lobster a second day. But he said, that first time I did something, I felt like I was going to get, like, I was going to get zapped and put in the dungeon. But that's not what happens. God's manipulating things behind the scenes. I'm not trying to make a value judgment. I'm just trying to point out that sometimes we think that if we don't get that lightning bolt reaction, means Hashem isn't involved in our lives. Hashem is 100% involved in our lives. I tell a story of a young boy who was starting to become religious, and the father was an atheist. He couldn't stand it. He's getting annoyed. He's got my kids believing in all this foolishness, this Nairishkeit. So I'm going to teach him a lesson. So he took a piece of paper, and before his kid was sleeping, he wrote a message to his son, and he said, God is nowhere. And he stuck it underneath the boy's pillow. Okay, so the kid wakes up in the morning. He comes running downstairs. He's so happy. He's waving this paper in the hand. The father says, what is that? He says, I got a message. I said, yeah, what does it say? He's explaining, God is nowhere. He says, I'm looking. I'm so happy. He says, what does it say? God is now here. It all depends how you read life's messages. The exact same event can happen and how you choose to see the messages. There's a beautiful story on H.com from Charlie Harari. He's a wonderful, very inspirational speaker. So he tells the story of a person who's frustrated and they're having a hard time and they go to see their spiritual mentor. And the person says to them, he takes them into a kitchen and he fills up 3 pots with water. And the person has no idea what's going on over here. He takes out a carrot, takes out an egg, and he takes out some coffee beans. He doesn't know what's going on. So without saying a word, his spiritual master takes a carrot, puts it into the first pot, takes an egg, puts it in the second pot, and puts the coffee beans into the third pot. And they sit there in silence for 20 minutes. And like, it's like awkward. He has no idea what's going on here. At the end of 20 minutes, turns off all 3 flames. And he says, let's look. Pulls out the carrot. And mushy and right and all that. Pulls out the egg and it's a hard boiled egg. Pulls out the third pot and it's a hot, it's a beautiful aroma of like Colombian geschmack coffee. So he says, look at 3 different things. They all were put in the exact same situation. They all had difficulty. They all had a hot boiling water. But there were 3 different reactions to the exact same situation. The carrot went in strong and hard and fought. Came out mushy. The egg went in soft on the inside, with a very thin shell on the outside, but afterwards it became hard on the inside, bitter, detached. One thing took the experience of the hot water and used it to bring out its potential. It became delicious smelling coffee. So that's the lesson in life. We have a choice how we're going to respond to difficulties, to challenges, to obstacles. Are we going to be like carrots? We're going to be like an egg? We're going to be like some coffee? I like coffee. I like Starbucks more than Dunkin' Donuts. But that's a beautiful idea that Charlie Harari says, that the person can choose how they're going to respond to it. Esther could have done any of these things, but she decided how she was going to respond to all these situations. I think that's another connection between her and Yosef. Yosef also could have decided, based on life circumstances, to throw in the towel, but he didn't. Esther doesn't quit. She realizes that it's time for me. If I want things to happen, I have to be more active. Like those Jews who are in Eretz Yisrael who are rebuilding the temple, I need to be like that type of action, not wait for things to be handed to me. I need to do my hishtadlis, my effort, and be proactive. I just wanted to end with something that a friend of mine sent me today, Super Bowl. the Nick Foles, right? Was the did you see this already? The speech he gave. If you have, did he? So let me read you this speech that he said. This is fantastic. I think the big thing is don't be afraid to fail. I think in our society today, Instagram, Twitter, it's a highlight reel. It's all the good things. And then when you look at it, when you think like, wow, when you're having a rough day, my life's not as good as that. You think you're failing. Failure is part of life. It's part of building character and growing. Without failure, who would you be? I wouldn't be up here if I hadn't fallen thousands of times, made mistakes. We're all human. We all have weaknesses. And I think throughout this, it's been important to be able to share that and to be transparent. I know when I'm listening to people speak and they share their weaknesses, I'm listening because it resonates. So I'm not perfect. I'm not Superman. I might be in the NFL. I might have just won a Super Bowl. But hey, we still have daily struggles. I still have daily struggles. And that's where my faith comes in. And that's where my family comes in. I think when you look at a struggle in your life, you just know that it's an opportunity for your character to grow. And that's just been the message. Simple. If something's going on in your life and you think you're struggling, embrace it because you're growing.
That was a speech.
That's a speech. Yeah, you want to... Nick Foles. Fantastic. I think that's a powerful message that relates to what we were talking about with Esther and with Yosef. And Lahavdil now relates to Nick Foles. The idea of embracing that as an opportunity. Because at the end of the day, life is like one big Megillas Esther. We don't see all the time Hashem's role in our lives. But we have to believe 100% that we know. Deep down, we all know that God is controlling every single thing in our lives and manipulating things to putting us in touch with the people with who we need to be in touch with and putting us in the situation that we need to be in, because there's something unique and special that we can bring out precisely in that location. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.